Critical Theory in Context.
Welcome to Critical Theory in Context, the podcast of the Center for Social Critique at Humboldt University Berlin. I'm your host, Jacob Blumenfeld. This two-part episode consists of two interviews I did with the keynotes of a workshop we organized at Humboldt in December 2025 called The Grounds of Planning, Rationality, Pseudo-Rationality, and Critique. The first interview is with John O'Neill on the socialist calculation debate, and the second interview is with Aaron Beninov on utopianism. But before we come to these interviews, I have Rahel Yegi here with me, co-director of the Center for Social Critique, to introduce the conversation and the topic. Hello, Rahel.
Hi, Jacob.
So let's talk about planning, rationality, and critique a little bit. Rahel, what did you find interesting in this workshop?
Oh, there was a lot that I found interesting. I had learned so much. First of all, I would say that why it was so important to do this, and it was such a good idea to organize this. Thank you. Because in some way it cannot be avoided, I think. The whole question of planning cannot be avoided. If we want to criticize capitalism, if we want to go deeper into analyzing the crisis of capitalism and democracy, if we want to be democratic socialists, the whole question of, how to reorganize the economy and how to do this in a way that is compatible with a certain way of living, a certain idea of freedom, but also of fulfilling everyone's needs. And when it comes to this, the old question of how to plan an economy and whether economy can be planned is just obvious. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people would avoid it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a good thing to do this. What I took from it is that somehow the old alternative between planning and the market seems to be outdated. And mm-hmm. The old argument that planning is impossible because you cannot predict needs, you cannot predict desires, you shouldn't interfere, you shouldn't come up with the idea of some basic needs that should be fulfilled and criticizing mm-hmm. needs on this basis and so on, and that this all would lead to an acceptable kind of paternalism. So these old debates, not only that it's ineffective, planning economy cannot work, just look at the old so-called socialist countries. Mm-hmm. They were not able to fulfill consumers' needs and to produce the kind of entrepreneurship and innovation that is needed and that can only the market can provide us with this. So this alternative and also the old argument that those who are in favor of a planned economy have a wrong concept of rationality and of the transparency. This kind of transparent rationality when it comes to needs and fulfilling the needs and so on. So this seems to be outdated. Mm-hmm. The rich discussions that were presented at the conference, what I learned from it is that there is some kind of not only those concepts who would say, we could have some market elements and some planned, some elements of a planned economy. We also had positions who would say, no. If the market comes into this, then everything is it's over. But I would frame it differently. It's some kind of experimentalist planning economy that all of a sudden, or for me, it somehow came as a surprise how well developed those ideas of combining experimentalism and planning.
Yeah.
And how also to come up with a new idea of rationality here.
Yeah, yeah. There's at least two reasons why talking about planning is kind of scandalous still. One is because, living in Germany, the GDR and people's memories of shortages, right? So how can we talk about planning after the experience of East Germany? Another is just from the perspective of critical theory. How can we talk about the future in a sense? When shouldn't we be focused on criticizing the present? And I think what this workshop showed was how we can talk about the future in kind of dynamic, open ways and also have a critical relationship to but also an open relationship to the past, learning from past experiences, what went right, what went wrong, to not have any full-scale rejections, but to also kind of be open to what present technologies and present kind of concepts allow us to plan and think about in the future.
You know, what I also liked about him in the way that you did it was that we had this first day that was focused on Hayek and Neurath,
yes,
which did not also show, I mean, like the long history of those debates, mm-hmm, but also, I mean, to focus on those classical texts and then everyone, I mean, this was like the reference and established some common ground so that even those who are not specialists in this debate could follow.
Yeah.
I don't know. What did you get out of it?
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, Otto Neurath and Friedrich Hayek, none of whom would identify as critical theorists, quite the contrary, actually, you know.
Of course.
And, but they're also like key figures in thinking through arguments for and against planning, for and against socialism, for and against markets. So the idea here is, you know, let's go back to these primary texts, see what we can learn, especially from Otto Neurath's understanding of pseudo-rationality, the kind of the limits of reason, and also Hayek's understanding of capitalism as kind of a form of gathering knowledge from people, right? And how do you take these arguments seriously? How do you invert them, criticize them, put them in a dialogue with each other? And how can they be useful for a critical theory of society today? I find really helpful and relevant. I mean, whether or not their proposals work, kind of the questions they pose, like how do you integrate the limits of knowledge into planning for the future? Instead of proposing this idea that you can already have kind of a formal metric or a formal rationality, that allows us to think a bit more openly about what are the tasks of critical theory.
I mean, this is a general problem. Limits of knowledge with respect to the future is,
I mean,
even if we do not talk about the economy, trying to figure out how to reorganize democracy, how to revive democracy, mm-hmm, how to, I don't know, change our form of life with respect to the crisis, the multiple crises that we're facing. All of it is like, how can we predict what kind of arrangement, what kind of institution would then have as a side effect or some consequences that are not what we expected and so on. So this is what I mean by there's a larger, like an experimentalist idea of rationality here, that rationality does not mean that you know already, I mean, that you know everything in advance, but it and can are in control of everything, but that it means to somehow follow the, I mean, to have ways to organize the process of liberation and the process of planning a society or developing institutions that would be able to fill to fulfill people's needs.
I mean, speaking of needs, right? This is like a common thing also in the history of this discussion is how do you take needs as a social category seriously, right? And if you want to, you know, how do you allow not only for a kind of a baseline list of needs, but allow needs to develop through time, right? Through change, through new kind of social technologies and new standards of living. I think this is a kind of a key question that I found really interesting in this project of thinking about planning. Can you plan for needs, right? How do you do that? I mean, what do you think about this?
I mean, I do think that needs is like the other elephant in the room, and that there's of course an obvious connection to the question of planning. And there has been, and this is something that figures prominently in the history of critical theory, because the insight that already comes from Marx, that needs are malleable, that they develop through history and that they develop in an interaction with the environment and the cultural environment and so on. This is something that critical theorists share, that there's no such thing as just, I mean, basic needs or needs that are like prehistorical.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you want to be able to refer to needs and to the fact that certain capitalist arrangements do not fulfill people's needs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You'd want to use this as a standard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's and not only it's an open question how to do this, but it's also something where, I mean, one of my favorite Adorno citations is where he says human beings need food that is not disgusting. And that's, I think, I mean, that says everything, because it's like you need food, yes, but you need food that is not disgusting. And everyone knows that what is disgusting is not just an individual, it's not just a matter of individual taste, but also of the culture.
Yeah.
So you have like the cultural and the constructive side and the natural side of it at the same time. Yeah, there are needs, and people are going to die if the needs are not fulfilled.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is like the level on which we have to discuss it, and the level on which we need to proceed. And then, of course, it's a lot about, I would say that the discussion about like false needs and so on is an interesting and important one. We need to have this discussion if we want to thematize some of the, I mean, obvious problems that we're facing. I mean, I personally would then go in the direction of looking at how those needs are influenced, shaped, formed, how a certain kind of shaping then interferes and so on. So that would be like on the second order level, so to say, how do these needs come about in the first place?
Yeah.
But again, I mean, how should I know what future generations need?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that became the focus of this discussion about rational planning in the future, in a sense, without it being technocratic, right? Without having a technocratic kind of institution that can just make lists for everything people need. How do you allow for that openness, experimentality, democratic discussion for figuring out who we are in the process of deciding our future?
Something that came as a surprise for me was that the new discussion on planning is not just about like this digital optimism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in the DDR, you couldn't do it. I mean, they failed because they didn't have the like technical means. And there are positions, of course, who have this kind of techno-optimism, the kind of digital optimism, and who would say, you know, nowadays we can proceed so much data that it's not a problem at all. And I found it, I mean, very, very interesting and very helpful that this is not like the main... The mainstream of those who were at this conference.
I think what's interesting is that it was about more what conceptions of reason would allow for a plurality of needs to develop, what conceptions of reason that cannot be reduced to a single metric, a single value, a single medium, like money or prices or labor or energy. What can incorporate kind of ecological constraints or technological possibilities or social needs? How do we think about the trade-offs between these in deciding on what to produce and how to distribute it? I think that was kind of a key axis in this workshop on planning, and it's also just a key debate in the planning discussion in general, right? How do you make decisions across these qualitatively distinct dimensions of life?
Mm-hmm.
Can you reduce them to something like, you know, a common good, or should we allow for a plurality of goods, right? With the kind of institutions or goals to be fulfilled in the process. And I think, like, you know, technology it allows for kind of new ways of combining these, but it doesn't solve the problem, right? Because the problem is social.
I mean, don't you think that there was an agreement in the room that there should be a plurality of goods? And at the same time, an agreement, or I would say one of the outcomes of the critique of the market that is behind this discussion and the discussion about planned economy is like the ideological character of the assumption that market, the way that market not only provides us with information, but also the way the market shapes what we can consume, what we see as goods, how we, I mean, treat what is seen as a good and what has value and so on. And then this ideology that the market would be like the neutral way, whereas once you start debating what kind of goods we should go for and provide people with, this then is paternalism, whereas market is not paternalism. And I think it's very important to see that This is not true. I mean, there's market paternalism. The market itself shapes its goods in a certain way.
And it shapes needs as well.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons why I think I wanted to read Otto Neurath is because, you know, when he discussed planning, he called it socialization at this point. I mean, now there's kind of a differentiation between socialization as a process of transformation and planning in terms of like the system for the economy. But tying back this discussion to the project of socializing economy and what that means, I think makes it relevant also for today, in which there are campaigns for socializing housing and basic infrastructure and basic goods. And, you know, we want to discuss what is the role of planning in that, what's the role of democracy, and what's the role of transformation.
But what is the role of democracy? I mean, the interesting thing about the socialization debate is that it has a strong, I mean, there's an idea of democracy that is implied and that it's like, that is like the core of it. And I do think, I mean, the something like an experimentalist planning has emerged during this conference, but also the emphasis on democracy here, which sets it apart from technocratic planning. But what do you think is, I mean, how is democracy and planning
connected? I think this is difficult, yeah, because, you know, how much can you democratize or how much participation can you have in deciding about what should be produced when economic good, when there's millions of economic decisions to be made every day now, and no one can discuss all of them. So you need to have mechanisms, whether technical, political, social, institutional, to make choices. And then, you know, too much democracy would mean too many meetings. But too much.
Don't you like meetings?
No. Sometimes. And then too many technical instruments means just giving up democracy all the way. So I think it's an open question, like what is the balance here? And that was one of the key points of discussion we had.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, that was a reflection on some of the themes we had at the conference in December. And now following this, we're going to have the interview with John O'Neill. Thank you very much, Rahel, for being here.
Thank you, Jacob.
Today in the studio, I have as my guest John O'Neill, professor of political economy and philosophy at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom. John is here today to give a keynote at a two-day workshop organized by the Center on the topic of rationality and economic planning. The focus of the workshop is on what does it mean to plan an economy rationally, and what counts as rational. The workshop revisits key moments in the theoretical development of economic planning, from the classic disputes between Hayek, Mises, and Neurath, to contemporary debates over ecological rationality and algorithmic coordination. The point is not only to reanimate past debates, but to ask how planning might be rethought today, given the different logics of ecology, technology, politics, and democracy. Other speakers are Aaron Benanov, Rebea Berfelde, Lilian Cicertia, Sove Dagan, Jan Gross, Max Grunberg, Jakob Haya, Christian Schmidt, Sandra Siron, Gabriel Warner, and myself. Now, John has written a ton of books and many articles. Some of the books that I first got interested with by John was The Market, Ethics, Knowledge, and Politics from 1998. A couple of his books on ecology from 2002 and 2007, including Ecology, Policy, and Politics, Human Well-being in the Natural World, and Markets, Deliberation, and Environment in 2007. But it's mostly his papers that really piqued my interest, especially this one called Who Won the Socialist Calculation Debate from 1996. But since then, he also wrote papers on Hayek and Neurath, Horkheimer and Neurath, papers on knowledge, planning, and markets, and the socialist calculation debate in general. So I'd like to just start by welcoming you, John. Thanks for coming here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And before we get into the specifics of the socialist calculation debate, I'd just like to ask you how you got interested in this debate in the first place.
Okay. So if you look at, you mentioned the book, The Market, and if you look at the introduction to that, the acknowledgements, I acknowledge the influence of two people, my dad and a building worker, both were building workers. My dad was a builder's laborer on building sites, shop steward. The other person was Joe McGecky, who actually taught me Marx in a canteen on a building site when my job had been mechanized. So we had plenty of time. And I was brought up in that kind of working class, self-educated, working class tradition. And they both, well, particularly Joe McGecky, not much my father, but Joe McGecky introduced me to kind of non-market socialism. I mean, he'd left school at 14, gone down a mine in a village in Scotland, came out of it and left the village the next day, and worked in factories and then on building sites, and was an anarchist, but then was interested in Marx. And so that was the kind of background. So I was brought up in conversations. The conversations you used to have in the pub used to be incredible, actually. It was like people sitting around talking about different models of socialism. And there was kind of syndicalist traditions, there was anarchist traditions, there was Marxist traditions, all there. And so that's where I got my early education. And what that led me to was this kind of long discussion about alternatives to capitalism, alternatives to, you know, various traditions of non-market socialism. So that's where it all started. And then Neurath's a really interesting figure for me in all of that, because he defended a form of radical socialization, right? With you know, in a non-market form. And so I got interested in him. And then you go into the socialist calculation debates, because you can see then the defenses of markets against Neurath's in-kind economy. And so ever since then, I've been interested in that debate to and fro, and the way that that debate's gone. And it's interesting also to see it through the renewed interest in it, yeah, like here. So I think there's a whole dimension of that socialist calculation. We can talk about this in a moment, that socialist calculation debate that went missing.
Okay.
And that's coming back now. So it has long, long roots in my early council estate upbringing.
That's right? Great. That's great. Yeah, so it's a debate that's about 100 years old by now, in a sense,
that's right?
Right?
Over 100 years.
Over 100 years. So let's start with that. So what is the socialist calculation debate? Can you tell me a little bit about what it was about and who was involved in it?
Okay, so I mean, the debate goes back before Neurath and Mises, but I'll start with Neurath and Mises. So Neurath, during the period after the First World War, defended various models of radical socialization in which he defended basically an economy in natura, or an economy in kind, as opposed to a money-based economy. And that led to a response by Mises. Right, and Neurath became the object of Mises' attack. So this was before, in a sense, the Russian Revolution and the debates that came out later on in that. And Mises' basic argument is for intermediate goods, that is, goods that are involved in the productive process higher up, right, yeah. In the absence of a measure of their various uses, rational economic choices couldn't be made, and that the only measure that could do that was a monetary measure, right? Yeah. So in the absence of a cardinal measure in that context, the rational economic organization would not be possible. You wouldn't know where the best uses of those intermediate goods were. So that kind of set up the debate, and it was a calculation debate. As I say, it was a socialist calculation debate. The way that the standard story, I mean, I always say that there wasn't a socialist calculation debate, there was debate. There was debate. The way that the standard story has been set up is that you then get Langer and the Langer-Taylor models, which basically accept the assumptions of Mises that you need a single cardinal measure. And Langer is explicitly critical of Neurath through, I mean, he doesn't mention Neurath, but he mentions Kautsky's criticisms of Neurath. So Langer basically accepts the model and does what I would call a kind of neoclassical socialism, right? So you use all the equilibrium models, and you show that through various marking, mimicking methodologies, you can arrive at various equilibria, which are optimal. Of that kind of then, the story then goes that Hayek comes along and says that the problem with the Langer response is it requires the centralization of all the economic knowledge that's dispersed through the actors in a market economy, and that a centralized planning board couldn't centralize all of that knowledge. And the reason it couldn't centralize it is for two reasons, I think. And the second one comes out more in the early papers. It's really because it's local knowledge, local in time and place. Right. And the entrepreneur becomes quite important in the later Austrians about this, that they've got that kind of perception of what's required here and now. The second, which I think is important, is knowledge how rather than knowledge that. It's practical knowledge. It's tacit knowledge, to use Polanyi's term. I like the Reilly term, knowledge how, rather than knowledge that. So it's not knowledge that can all be expressed in a propositional form that can then be sent up to a centralized planning agency. And so you've got to allow people to use their own local knowledge. And the price system for Hayek is basically an information signal that allows individuals to use their own local knowledge, but to coordinate their activities through that price signal, right? So you then get that argument in response, right? Yeah, and then you then have a variety of different responses to that, and the debate goes different ways about who won it. So you get, you know, you get various papers saying that, you know, like Roma says, basically the market socialist won the debate. You get other people that say no, especially after the 1980s, that the Austrians won it. What's interesting then, one of the founders of ecological economics, William Capp. This is a footnote to a footnote.
Yeah,
really.
Go for it.
He points out in a footnote that he thinks it all went wrong with the shift to Langer. Right, yeah. And that there was another debate. The early debate gets lost. So the early debate is really the one between Neurath and Mises. That early debate focuses on whether you can have a single measure of value to do rational economic activity in the use of resources and so forth. Neurath's argument was there was no measure, no single measure that would do the good job, right? Yeah, a monetary measure wouldn't do it. A labor time measure wouldn't do it. So he defends basically a form of value pluralism that says we need a variety of different measures about what is a good outcome, right? Yeah.
But what was his reason? What was his argument against the single measure of money? Being able to collect the information and knowledge, or being able to help us make decisions on how to.
I mean, there's a variety of different arguments, but I mean, the basic argument is an argument from value pluralism, right? That there's a variety of different values, and you can't capture them all in a single measure. So it's an incommensurability argument, right? And I can give you a variety of different arguments that are around there. That's the fundamental claim, that the search for this measure. So if you think about, you know, I mean, I yeah. let's take cross generationally, the intergenerational dimension might be a good way of doing it, right? If we're thinking about, if we just simply use a willingness to pay measure, then future generations, for example, can't express a willingness to pay, so they're at best represented indirectly through our willingness to pay, right? Yeah, and in market mechanisms, they just disappear. They don't count, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah, if you take a labor time measure, yeah. Right? Yeah, you can save a lot of labor time by having a very energy intensive economy, for example, but that might not be sustainable over a period of time. Or you could use an energy measure, which was around at the time, mm-hmm. Right? You use an energy measure that you could sort of save on energy by using lots more labor, mm-hmm. but that leads to a loss in working conditions, right? Lengthening of the working day and so forth. So you're looking at variety. You've got the needs of the future. You've got our current needs. We've got current needs across a variety of dimensions. It could be your health needs, your needs for certain kinds of social relationship. Neurath was defending various different people living different ways of life. And he thought that the money economy actually introduces a kind of lack of pluralism in people's lives. And if you go down any high street in Europe and it's all the same, you can kind of see what he means. Right, yeah. So it kind of produces a kind of monoculture rather than a pluriculture, a pluralistic culture. So there's an intergenerational and an ecological dimension to this about whether you could capture issues around sustainability adequately in a monetary measure. And then there's also just a basic argument about what it is to have a rational choice in economics, which maybe was at the top of the conference, so maybe we'll come back to that later on. So, but what got lost, and I think why Kat picks it up, is what got lost in that debate is simply thinking about how we meet human needs within various constraints, resource constraints, or various constraints of having a good labour life, good labour conditions, about having good relation, you know, balance between labour and non-labouring activities, about having meaningful work actually as well, I think is an important one. So there's a variety of different dimensions to life within work and outside of work, which is just not going to get captured in any single measure. So the idea we come along, and this is where the rationality point comes on, and there's an optimal outcome that you can produce, which is shared in a sense by Mises and Lange, right? Yeah, about this, the optimal use of resources and so forth is just simply false. And we can talk a little bit more about that later on when we talk about rationality.
I mean, I just kind of want to follow up with Neurath a little bit more, which is to say, can you tell me about what gave him the impetus to introduce kind of this concept of in-kind calculation and economic planning in the first place? Like, why did he think in-kind calculation and economic planning was even possible for a complex modern economy? And maybe, and just furthermore, like, what is in-kind calculation? Because that's maybe a term we've used but haven't really defined yet.
Okay, they're two great questions. I mean, the first thing I should say is prior to the First World War, he did a lot of historical work on the use of in-kind planning. So in-kind planning is using various statistical measures of the use of particular resources. So an obvious way of thinking about it is thinking about physical input-output analysis of an economy. You've got various physical resources coming in. You've got to use those resources in a sustainable way to meet human needs. So this is why he was so influential in ecological economics. So ecological economics starts saying, instead of talking about the money economy, let's talk about the real economy, which has got physical flows going through it, and there's the meeting of human needs at the other side. And we've got to think, and if we think about the money economy in abstraction, and this is one of Neurath's criticisms, you're abstracting away from the real physical flows through the economy. And so you miss issues around sustainability, for example, for that reason. And it's interesting that the sustainability argument was there for so early on. So what Neurath, his early historical writing was just looking at in-kind economies like that of ancient Egypt. Where it really came to the fore was once you got into war economies. Right. So war economies are actually much more like classic in-kind economies. Right. You're thinking about how you use various resources and direct various resources to achieve a particular end. Right. Yeah. So after the war, Neurath appealed back to the war economy, not as a for war, obviously, which he was very critical of, right? But thinking about how we use those resources in times of peace. There's actually, he worked later on, there's a wonderful film called The Land of Promise, and he worked with a documentary director, Paul Rota, and it's about housing, right? Yeah, and it was done during the Second World War. This is moving on a war.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful little sequence in that film, which is done in the woman's voice. She said, why do we only use resources rationally in this kind of physicalist sense in times of war? Why can't we actually think about how we build housing, How do we do housing and construct people in peace? And it's interesting that it comes in as the woman's voice in this kind of otherwise quite male film, right? Yeah, talking about the peacetime use of resources to realize. And there was moments, and Hobsbawm points this out, the moments of, and this is a real difficulty for socialists, I simply say this, the moments where socialism was talked about most strongly was actually after the two wars, right? And it's partly because of people's experience during the wars, right? They're thinking, okay, we've had various rationing systems, we've had systems where we move goods around in various ways, and, you know, life expectancy for civilians bizarrely increases more dramatically in wartime than it does in the First and Second World War than it does during the peacetime afterwards, right? So Sen points this out in one of his pieces. And it's because of this more equitable distribution of goods that happens. It's because people are thinking about what do you need nutritionally and so forth. So thinking of that then terms in how do we translate that into a peacetime economy to improve people's welfare was a big issue that came out in both times. So that's the immediate background. The other side, and this is produces a tension in Neurath's work. Neurath gave those talks on planning and his total socialization debates to the workers' councils in just after the war. So you're in the midst of a revolution, and he was director of socialization during the Bavarian Revolution. And ended up with, there was three different governments, if I remember rightly. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And he ended up in prison afterwards. Actually, Weber appeared in his defense, right, in court, right, yeah. And so he gave those talks. So there was a moment where it was looked quite... that was a revolutionary moment where they thought that things were going to change and could happen, and we could introduce this kind of social, what he called total socialization, into the economy. At the same time, he was heavily involved in the settlers' movement in Vienna, right? And so this was basically like people moving into certain areas and building their own housing and producing food around that. And so he was the secretary of the settlers' movement council, or whatever, I can't remember what the director, the term was. So he was involved with that, which was very much more localized and decentralized. And with that, you get, again, this, how do we do it? And people were giving up their labour time to do it, thinking there's a wonderful picture he has about how you build a house, which looks at all the different resources coming into it. And then he got, out of that, he got involved in with architects. Particularly Joseph Frank is an interesting person who he involved a lot about urban planning. And then you had Reb Vienna, which was the center of urban planning. And so you've got this kind of move between this kind of localized settlers movement. How does that get involved then within the kind of larger scale movement for workers' apartments and workers' housing in Reb Vienna, which was like a showcase for how you could do this? So he was heavily involved in that urban planning debate. And what was interesting again about his arguments there, he was against a certain kind of modernist architecture which simply imposed a picture of what architecture should be like from above, rather than thinking about what a good life for the people living in the houses would be. What do they want? What are their traditions? What is their ways of life and so forth? And that became a central... So where he was centrally involved in planning after the revolution earlier on was in those urban planning debates, where he was against what he later called a certain kind of totalitarianism of city planners that would come along and just say, this is what it's got to be like. Think about how you plan for spontaneity. How do you plan for different ways of life? And again, you've got this kind of pluralistic theme that's running through his arguments there. So that gives you a little bit about the background. So you've got the kind of war economy background, you've got this urban planning background, and you've got the German Revolution in the background.
I mean, from your examples there, it seems like there could be a tension between maybe this more what you can call like a top-down or centralized approach to socialization of the economy. In some of NORAD's early planning proposals, it can appear that to be very centralized or even authoritarian, right? There's a central planning office. There's other offices below it. They make decisions, they make plans, and they get sent down to the workers, right? On the other hand, there's all these bottom-up housing projects of people taking their own decisions in their own hands. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate portrayal of NORAD's understanding of economic planning? Did he have both this kind of top-down and bottom-up, or a technocratic and a democratic aspect to him? Or how did he conceptualize this kind of question?
I think it's really good. It's a brilliant question. I mean, I think there's a real tension in Neurath's work. So I think on the one hand, you have these socialization plans, which are, as you say, are incredibly centralized, right? Yeah. And you have a centralized, I mean, one of the interesting things about the centralized plan is he thinks then there's lots of local autonomy about how you realize it. And he even thought that it could be an anarchist community. As long as they met their targets, it didn't matter how they organized their lives. I don't think he was ever a technocrat or kratocratic socialist, and I'll come back to that. I think that's one of the great myths about Neurath. But he thought what you did is presented various options, and then you allow people to deliberate about them. But it was incredibly centralized. At the same time, on the ground, as I've said, he's involved in all of these very bottom-up approaches, right? Yeah. And when guild socialism came around, he was very sympathetic to guild socialism, but thought you still needed this central coordinating device. So that was a real tension from the start, I think, in Neurath. And I don't think he ever really clearly resolved that tension. I think it's a really important tension about how you have local democratic planning on the one hand, and this, at the same time, defending this centralized plan on the other. And despite the fact that he gave these talks to workers' councils, he wasn't a council communist, right? Yeah. And the council communists were quite critical of him and critical of in-kind planning, because they thought that would lead to a kind of, again, a kind of centralized over the top of the workers rather than from the workers. I think that's unfair to Neurath. I mean, I think if you look at the whole workers' education he was involved in with the isotypes, this visual statistics, it was all about how you actually allowed workers to be involved in thinking about planning seriously. But you had this definitely state, you know, this centralized model. I think that gets, that shifts in the 30s, actually. And you get a criticism of what he called state pyramidism, the idea that you can kind of just plan from above down to below. So I think the tension moves a little bit. And if you look at his later work of Planning for Freedom, yeah, he talks there about of an association of associations. It's that idea that you have an association of associations and you have an overlapping association. So if you've got a river, you have to plan around the river, for example, and rather than across, and that moves across what would be traditional national boundaries and so forth. So you might have a river plan, you might have rail plans, you might have lots of different plans across different associational forms. And so he thinks much more in that a kind of associational way. Whether he actually resolves that tension adequately is a big issue, right? And it's not clear to me he does, right? Yeah. Where I think it comes, where the localized comes through most clearly, I think, is in the urban planning area, where he's very clearly against. I mean, one of the problems he has with the a particular kind of modernist architecture is it comes along and says, this is how people will live, right? Without recognizing the variety of ways people live in different contexts and different ages and different how you bring communities together. So he always wanted to give people, you know, you need architects, right? Yeah, people can't do, you need experts. And but there's always what he calls in his later writings this conflict between the expert and the democratic man. And what you need to do always is present options, right? Yeah, rather than present, this is how we do it. And that's what he tried to do with Joseph Frank. So Joseph Frank and him, when they were involved in the city planning in Vienna, it was all around offering workers different possibilities about how the architecture of the and how the internal, you know. And Joseph Frank's interesting. I mean, he became very, I mean, if he's a bit like William Morris. It's like you're for the workers and you do all this design, but your designs end up being used by the very rich, right? Right, yeah. It's a such similar problem. But he was very important in Swedish time. I mean, in Sweden, he moved from Vienna to Sweden because of the rise of the Nazis. And there, he was incredibly influential in Swedish design, actually, and architecture. But you've got this kind of picture back then of a kind of much more pluralistic picture of modernism, as Frank had it. And him and Neurath shared that. But you do have this tension in Neurath's work, and I think it's there throughout, actually. And it gets resolved in different ways at different periods in his writing. But I don't think it's ever fully resolved, because you do have a problem. If you're going to have a radical non-market economy, how do you coordinate economic activities? And that's the issue. You want to kind of create conditions in which you can have that coordination without this kind of incredibly centralized body which kind of tries to direct everything, which I think actually Hayek has good arguments against. I mean, I think the most important contribution from the Austrians actually was the Hayekian one about local knowledge.
Let's get into that right now. let's turn to Hayek, because in your paper, Who Won the Socialist Calculation Debate, you do make this interesting claim that actually Neurath and Hayek are kind of on the same side. I mean, more if you abstract from their politics in a sense, right? They're more on the same kind of theoretical or conceptual side in terms of their understanding of calculation and commensurability against Oscar Lange and Mises, who both assume that you can have prices and or that you can have kinds of calculations in planning. So tell me more about Hayek's arguments against centralization and his kind of specific role in the socialist calculation debate, according in your perspective.
Okay. Yeah, so Hayek's shift in the argument was shift from a calculation argument to an epistemic argument. So the central argument is that a centralized body requires the centralization of all knowledge to do the coordination. And that's not possible. And as I said before, it's not possible for two reasons. One is that much of the knowledge is local to time and place. The other is know-how. And what's interesting is Hayek associates that picture of planning with what he calls an engineering mentality. He thinks that actually what you want is social engineers. And it's a term that Neurath uses, actually, is being a social engineer, that will centralize all of that, all the knowledge that you needed, like you have in an engineer has, have complete knowledge of an area, and you then use it to optimally design, you know, and he talks about optima again, optimal outcomes, where you come along and say, this is the optimal use of resources. Right. What I think's interesting, that Neurath, and it does use the word social engineer, but I think he has a much more realistic view of what engineering's like, right? Yeah. And if you know I've got lots of friends who are engineers, right? Yeah. One of the things about engineers is they know things don't work. They know they haven't got complete knowledge. That kind of picture that Hayek has of this person, this engineer that has complete knowledge of an area is just false, right? Yeah. That's not what engineering's like. And so Neurath, early on, was very critical about what he called pseudo-rationalism, right? Yeah, and pseudo-rationalism is precisely the idea that there's kind of rules of rationality which will give you the optimal outcome, the single best outcome, right? Yeah, and he has a variety of different arguments for that. One is the incommensurability argument we've talked about. Right, yeah. And this comes in more in the later writings, is that you've got these variety of dimensions of a good life. You've got variety of needs. A feature of that, I mean, I think it's true of any needs or multidimensional picture of well-being. You've got variety of thresholds that you have to meet. So what Kapp calls social minima, right? And you need heterogeneous resources to meet those, right? Yeah. And the idea that you could have and what you're going to end up with then is what in, you know, logicians call partial orderings rather than total orderings. You'll get, you know, one option is better on these dimensions, another option is better on these dimensions, but you've left with two different what Sen would call maximal options, which are better than others, but you might not be able to compare them directly across. So Norat was aware of that. The other arguments, however, are kind of interesting. This is where it comes with Hayek, is epistemic arguments, right? So in The Lost Wanderers of Descartes, his earliest 9 paper, he's talking about people in conditions of radical uncertainty. They're lost in the middle of the forest, right? Yeah, what do you do in that context? The rationalist says, oh, we work out with reason. There's limits to what reason can do there, right? Yeah. Later on, where it becomes, I think, even more interesting is in the logical empiricist views of science, right? So Neurath saw Popper as a pseudo-rationalist. Right. There's a famous paper of him, a critical of Popper. And the reason why Popper, he still thought, was a pseudo-rationalist is even if he's got falsification, he thinks there's definitive points where you say this is now false, right? Yeah. What Neurath was very well aware of right from the beginning was the way that theories confront the reality as a whole, right? Yeah. So you can always make adjustments at various points in your theoretical framework. So when you say there's not a simple falsification that goes along and says the theory is false, because you can adjust. You can say we'll reject this bit of it. You know. So when you get an observation which says that planet's not moving in that direction, you can say, well, there must be another planet, which is exactly what people, you know, there's various ways you can save a theory. Right, so you have a much more, what he would call what's later called the underdetermination of theory by practice. And there's a famous image that he uses of, right. Of the sailors at sea, you know, reconstructing the boat as they go along. There's no dry dock to get to sort it out. So you have that kind of underdetermination theory that science is, and it's not just at the level of theory. He also thought at the level of observation statements. Sometimes, you know, it's the actual, what you would call protocol statements that get revised. So there's revision. So he never talks about theories being verified or falsified in that kind of way. They're kind of challenged by empirical evidence and supported or undermined, but there's never any definitive answer. So you have a much. So he actually, in a letters to Hayek, he says, "Why are you with this Popper guy when you should be with me? I'm a pluralist, and we share this view on knowledge, right? Yeah." I think there's a difference. So there's similarities. And at the same time, so he talks about pseudo-rationalism. Hayek is a critic of, when he talks about social engineering, is a criticism of what he calls Cartesian rationalism, that there's this kind of rationalist picture that you can actually come up with the optimal answer through the application of rational rules of investigation. So they share a kind of criticism of a certain kind of rationalism. And that's the interesting commonality. And in his letters to Hayek, he keeps saying, we're on the same side on this. There is a really important difference, right? Yeah. And I think there's in two places. One, the nature of Hayek's argument is much more about not the nature of science, but it's about local knowledge, local to time and place, and it's knowledge how. And Neurath, in his response, says, you're right about that, right? Yeah, so he gives it. But that's not the center of Neurath's argument. Neurath's argument is arguments about science. And I think that raises really interesting arguments, problems for both of them, actually, right? So once you allow for the local knowledge, which Neurath had seen, you know, when he was doing his urban planning with the settlers movement, of the kind of local knowledge they had, that raises issues for a very centralized model of planning, and his early centralized model of planning, actually, where you assume complete knowledge. And I think that's why you get these shifts in Neurath's writing. At the same time, there's real problems for Hayek, because the Hayek accepts there's scientific knowledge, right? And actually, scientific, if you take, you know, take the knowledge of climate change, for example, right? There's knowledge like that which matters to the way the whole economy is going to operate, right? Yeah. And which a few people will have and isn't dispersed, right? And Hayek's response to that is to say, okay, we've got all this, we've got the scientific generic knowledge, as he called it, and then we've got local knowledge. What do we do to coordinate those different ones? Hayek's thing is, oh, we've got to decentralize all that knowledge. We've got to spread it all out, right? That doesn't work on his own view because precisely science itself involves tacit knowledge. He quotes Polanyi, you know, on this, right? Yeah, that there's this knowledge which scientists have, which you can't, you know, I don't know the details of the climate science, right? I don't think anyone apart from really good climate scientists knows the details of it. If you take science itself, it's the whole scientific community depends on the fact that different people have different bits of knowledge and you rely on that knowledge. So most of what we believe, and I would say this, we believe on the basis of testimony. We believe because someone told us. Even things as simple as Britain is an island. I've never gone around it, right? I know that because of testimony, right? So we're relying on other people's knowledge all the time. And you can't disperse all scientific knowledge like that. So the real problem we have, but we do need to use that scientific knowledge, and we need to, and this is where it looks like you have to go a bit more centralized, right? Yeah, we've got to use that knowledge for making climate policy, and that climate policy has got to apply everywhere. This is using a modern example, obviously not Neurath and Hayek's example. But Hayek recognized that. So his argument of what we've got to do is disperse all that knowledge just doesn't work, right, at all. So what you've got then is the issue that precisely that Neurath recognized, that you've got scientific expertise on the one hand, but you don't want the rule of the technocrat, right? And on the other hand, you've got people with their own local knowledge, and they've got people that have been... So there's what he calls a kind of constant conflict between the need for expertise and a proper skepticism of expertise at the same time. And interestingly, he kind of at the time, and it's become much more relevant now, kind of waves in the direction of the kind of Athenian citizens panel, right? Yeah, but that's, and it's a very slight wave, right? It's there, but the idea that you need various ways of democracy of allowing people to look to how you can interrogate science and scientific expertise, with it, while at the same time accepting its importance. So it's exactly that. And the other side, I think, which this becomes really important, is what's the conditions for the trust in testimony of others. So we're reliant on testimony. I think that goes right down into Neurath's, deep into Neurath's writing. Thomas Ugel's written some good stuff on this. We're reliant on that. So the question then becomes an institutional question, is, and it's become one that's become really central again in the modern context, is how do we make sure that we have trustworthy sources of knowledge, right? And what happens once you get a kind of total market in knowledge is you lose that notion of trustworthy sources of knowledge. So that's the world we've moved into now with algorithms, which are just around attention, is precisely we've used into this kind of world in which people say, I don't know who to trust, right? And that's become a real problem because we're losing the institutional conditions for trustworthy knowledge and for testimony. And that's a big epistemic problem. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in that context, I think people turn to the market. They're like, well, I don't know what to trust. I'll just trust the market, right? I'll just trust, you know, the prices. I'll trust that. I'll trust what the, you know, and that's obviously not the...
Well, I think it's worse than that because once you get... I mean, what you've had is the kind of privatization of public spaces. Oh. So you've got models which are basically there to keep your attention so you read more adverts, right? And those algorithms are then what take you down those kind of strange and weird places where you believe in conspiracy theories and all that, because that's what keeps people's attention. So it's no longer around epistemic criteria for where you find the information, but it's around basically, I think, fundamentally market-based criteria that's between the moving, right? It's how you make maximum money out of those sites.
I'd like to continue this discussion by going on to another question about value in general and commensurability and plurality. So we've brought up this idea of incommensurability of values in Neurath, and the counter to that by von Mises and Lange. I'm wondering today, how does this idea of a plurality and incommensurability of value fit with standard economic approaches, or how does it challenge standard economic approaches? Does it, and what are some of the implications for policy or planning or the environment today?
I think there's massive implications. It's where I spend a lot of my time doing environmental policy. So if you think about, you know, the value of biodiversity, for example, or you think about the value of places to people, right, or so forth. Standard economic approach is, and to be fair, this isn't the Austrians now, this is standard neoclassical economics, right? The standard approach is that you, and Austrians would be critical of some of this as well, the standard is you ask people how much they're willing to pay for a certain good, right? Yeah, so it might be change to a certain landscape, but then it normally have to be done in terms of marginal changes of various kinds. And what you get as a result of that is people just protest. You're saying, this is not the sort of thing I think of in terms of monetary values at all. It's a bit like turning around and saying, you know, how much you're willing to pay for your, you know, the life of your grandmother, or how much you're willing to pay for X, Y, and Z. It just doesn't make sense. There's what Joseph Raz calls constitutive incommensurabilities. There's certain commitments to certain ethical goods, to certain social relations, which are expressed through saying this is not something I can express in monetary terms. So the idea that you could express all value in terms of monetary value just misses the fact that a lot of our values are the kind where you say this, you precisely, if asked that question, you'd say, that's, you know, money's not the right metric. And it's not, the economist comes along and says, you're saying it's got infinite value. That misses the point. I'm saying it's that's still saying it's monetary metric. It's just very, 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 well, it's infinitely big, right? They're saying it's just not the right metric at all in the first place. So you couldn't and shouldn't try and express those relationships to friends. If someone turns around to me, you know, I'd say to people, you know, if I say to my, you know, my partner, you know, I love you so much, it would take about £1,000 to leave you. And she says, what? And I said, oh, sorry, I meant about £20,000. Moving the sum up doesn't make any difference. I've already lost it, right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. It's like, that's not the way that you could express love, right? Yeah, and it's not, and you get it with people with their love of places that they live in, right? Yeah, and you say, you come out, how much is it? And, you know, and the answer is, that's not the appropriate way of thinking about it. How much to protect a species. Yeah. That you really care about, you know, that's not the way to think about it. So people, when they do those kind of surveys, reject it, right? Yeah. So what you need is something much closer to a kind of Neurathian democratic deliberation. So you've got problems, you've got to use, you know, you've got health needs, for example, you've got to build hospitals, you've got environmental needs that you want to protect certain environmental spaces. You've got social needs of communities and how they're going to keep within certain social relations with each other. You've got a variety of different social and environmental needs. And what you need is much more deliberative spaces where people can discuss that. And finally, even when you come to a decision at the end of that, you've got to recognize there are losses and there's no compensation for that loss, right? There's people come along and say, you know, I have huge arguments at the moment about net gain and no net loss approaches to biodiversity. And actually there's losses which are simply losses. There's no gain that's going to compensate for those losses there. And so it matters massively to environmental policies at the moment. So there's a big divide within economics about this between the environmental economics tradition, which is very neoclassical and which is based really around the idea of monetary commensurability in the end, that we can put a monetary value on that and we can come up to the ideas, you get it in reports, what's the optimal biodiversity loss? What's the optimal this, that, and the other? And the ecological economic tradition, which really comes out of Neurath, Kapp, which thinks about the physical flows through an economy, and then also thinks about the plurality of values and the need for various forms of democratic deliberation to resolve those. So I could talk about this for a long, long time. And it matters to local communities, right? Yeah. So I work with various local community defending green spaces, and you get authorities come along and saying, don't worry, there's no net loss here, there's a net gain in biodiversity, and they're losing a really important, this could be a local working class community in a city, a really important area of nature that's close to them, right? Yeah. And they're told it's fine because biodiversity is going to have a net gain because we're going to build something else somewhere else. Right, yeah, and I can give you a whole other talk on that, but I'll stop there.
No, I mean, it's this idea that things can be reversed or offset later, as if they're equivalent, as if time and space don't matter for human beings.
But it's not just time and space; it's also the value lost at this place can be replaced by somewhere else. There's a distinction that I've used between de re and de dicto valuation. So de re valuation is where you value a particular thing, right? Yeah. I'll give you the bad joke. There's a, and this is terrible, actually. I'll give you a bad joke and then I'll explain it. So the bad joke is about Zsa Gabor. So an interviewer says to Zsa Gabor, who was a socialite, for people who don't remember, you know, Zsa Gabor says, you know, people think I'm just a socialite, I don't do anything, but hey, I found a way of keeping my husband young and healthy forever. And the interviewer says, wow, that's an incredible thing. How did you do that? And she says, I get a new one every 5 years. Right, yeah. And the point is when she says she's going to keep her husband young and healthy, you think she's a particular person, her husband, and she's going to keep that person young and healthy. So it's a de re valuation. It's of that particular person. The only thing that she marries is what Mark is concerned about. It's a de dicto valuation, that whoever falls under the description of being my husband, that they're young and healthy. So, and she, you know, see, every 5 years you get a new one and they stay young and healthy, right? Yeah. What happens with a lot of biodiversity policy, I mean, that people come along and I'm working with a local community and there's this particular place that really matters to them, right? That they value de re. It's this place with its history that they've had with it and so forth. And someone else comes along and says, well, as long as they say the next place has the same biodiversity properties plus some, that's all that matters. So you do a replacement. And even de dicto replacements are difficult because it depends on the level of description. So if it's simply, if it's this ancient woodland that you're defending is one thing, right? Yeah, and you've got how do you replace an ancient woodland, right? Yeah, right. If you're looking at the properties, it's got very, very particular properties, right? But if you simply say we're going to replace a woodland with a woodland, it's easy to do, right? Yeah, so it depends on what the description is, and that's where a lot of the debates happen with net gain and net loss. But we're going way off the socialist calculation debate.
No, that's great. I wanted to see the legacy and the threads that it unravels how it kind of affects day-to-day policy and thinking today. So I really appreciate that. Maybe just to follow up on this, I mean, do you believe that not having a single metric of value, like prices or labor, energy, does this require a different conception of rationality?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got a kind of conception of rationality which just reduces. I mean, who's very influential here, and I'll just say this, is in the debate, Polanyi, Karl Polanyi, not Michael Polanyi was who Popper referred to. Karl Polanyi and Kapp were both interested in. If you go back to the original socialist calculation debate, there was two criticisms of Neurath that were around. There was the Mises criticism that everybody knows about. Much more interested was Weber's. And Weber, in response to Neurath, basically makes a distinction between formal and substantive rationality. So formal rationality is the degree to which you can reduce a rational decision to calculation, right? And he thinks that monetary metrics produce formal rationality, right? Yeah. But you've then got substantive rationality, which is a system of provisioning, and you can see the interest in, well, Karl Polanyi comes out of this, a system of provisioning to meet some various ends. And, you know, for Kapp, it would be meeting various social minima across a variety of different dimensions. So you've got that notion of substantial rationality, which doesn't reduce everything to a matter of calculation. Right, yeah. So there's a distinction between calculative reason and reason, which deliberates between, you know, we've got provisioning and how do we realize various values. That distinction becomes quite important in later work by, it was influential on Kolpelanyi, but in Kapp. So Kapp is this really important figure in the development of ecological economics. And he says, you know, the debate goes wrong when we shifted from Neurath and Weber to Langer, right, yeah. And what gets lost is that notion of substantive rationality, right, yeah. So what Kapp says in his contributions to the debate, and he did his PhD thesis again, actually partly on the direction of Mises, oddly, right, on socialist planning and the socialist planning and the socialization debates, the socialist calculation debates. So he does it on that, but in his later writings, he basically says what we need is, and what the environment shows us more than anything else, is we need substantive rationality. So we've got to think about the physical, we've got to have real, in real physical terms, descriptions of the physical flows going into the economy. And we've got to think in terms of how we realize various social minima, right, across various dimensions. And you've got back to that idea of thresholds. So, to use the obvious example, if I'm really, really hungry and I've got nutrition loss, so I'm really down on the threshold of health on food, and someone comes along and says, but I've got this great novel, John, right? Yeah. It's really going to improve you on the educational dimension of a good life, or the dimension of cultural dimension of a good life. I'm below that threshold. There's no trade-off here at all. The idea that you could trade off across those dimensions doesn't work. So you've got certain thresholds of what Kapp calls social minima. And we've got to think of an economy in terms of how we realize various goods, realize at least social minima, and if possible, more flourishing. Those can shift with democratic deliberation over time. About how we realize those. And I think that's come more and more to the fore when we think about our environmental crisis. So what we've got, I think, are production and consumption corridors that we've got to stay within with limits of various kinds, you know, around with CO2 emissions, biodiversity loss, various what people call planetary boundaries. And there's a lot of debates around what those planetary boundaries are, but they're important there. And they're not purely scientifically defined, but science matters to them, right? They're also defined in what people consider to be social minima of various dimensions of well-being. So you've got the upper boundaries, and then you've got lower boundaries of how we realize various social, at least the social minima, and if possible, better, right, within that. So you've got those productive and consumption corridors. And I think what Kapp and Neurath get right is that's the problem that we face, right? So we've got to think much more in terms of the different kinds of heterogeneous goods that are coming into the economy. And we've got to think about how we realize the various different dimensions of well-being, right, within the boundaries that we have. And and in a sense, one of the problems with some optimistic views that came out of Marxism was that we just had this world of abundance. And I think actually we can have social abundance, actually. We can have what, you know, called public luxury, right? Yeah. But we've got to realize that's within real physical boundaries of a certain kind. And the whole of the ecological crisis has really brought those home, I think.
Just to return to Weber for one second, when Weber discusses formal rationality as the ability to calculate across kind of different dimensions, and he thinks that this is, in a sense, essential for any economy. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I think this is
the difference between Weber and Kapp. So I think Kapp picks up on that distinction and takes it a slightly different way than that Weber did, right? Yeah. So I think Weber thinks in any economy that you really, and one of the big issues is, and I think you do want, you do, I mean, if you're thinking in terms of, even in Neurath's, in kind calculation, you need calculation. It's still calculation. So the idea that you get rid of calculation, I think, is be crazy, right? Yeah, so no one's against calculation. The real issue is, Do we need calculation within one unit? Do we need that single cardinal unit in the end to money to do the calculations? And I think that's where the big question comes in. And the idea that you can reduce it all to a monetary metric is where the issue arises. Yeah.
So finally, I would be remiss not to bring up, as part of the Center for Social Critique, which is a center that's devoted to kind of the discussion around critical theory, the debate between Neurath and Horkheimer from the 1930s, if I recall, mm-hmm. right? Now, can you tell me a little bit about this debate? Was it, in fact, a missed opportunity?
I think it certainly was. And we've done a couple of papers on this with Thomas. So what happened there is that there was in the 30s this kind of meeting between Neurath and Horkheimer. So it started in 36. There was a meeting in The Hague between Neurath and Horkheimer. And Neurath visited the Institute for Social Research, which had relocated in New York on a couple of occasions for seminars on philosophy of science, metaphysics and dialectics and stuff. Right. And in the back, I'll just say there's a more general issue here. In the background, there's a certain kind of myth of the development of Western Marxism. So if you take someone like Karl Korsch, right, Karl Korsch was very, very sympathetic to logical empiricists and gave papers to the Berlin logical empiricist seminars on, of all things, Hegel as an empiricist, right? Yeah. Right, which I've got a copy of, which I must do an English translation
of. Oh, I need to read that.
Yeah,
I need that
right,
one.
Yeah, right. Well, maybe we should follow it up, actually, afterwards. So he was very sympathetic to and was very in defense of the logical empiricists against the Frankfurt School. And likewise, Bertolt Brecht. Brecht was very influenced by Neurath and had notebooks full of stuff on Neurath. And if you look at Benjamin and his was kind of between Brecht and Adorno. Benjamin would do lots of things where he was on Adorno's side against logical empiricists, but was saying this is where he was having the big fallouts with Brecht, actually. So the whole way that it's presented subsequently is not there. So what happened? There was some initial meetings in 36. The Institute actually provided support for Neurath to write his work on the standard of living, which defended this multidimensional account of well-being, which underpins what we've been talking about with commensurability. So that was there. Well, Neurath thought that the Frankfurt School were going to be part of the unified science umbrella. So he was thinking about how they could include the work of the Institute in the unified science. Horkheimer and Adorno always saw it as they were learning about logical empiricism to criticize it. Right? Yeah.
Spies.
And it came to a head really in Volume 6 of the Journal for the Social Research. I won't give the German because my German pronunciation. You can say what it is in German. It's the
Zeitschrift für Sozialforschung.
Yeah, 1937. And it has two papers in it. One is The Latest Attack on Metaphysics, which is a big critique of positivism by Horkheimer, including the work of Neurath. Neurath's one of the objects of criticism. But it also has Neurath's Inventory of a Standard of Living in the same thing, right? So it's got Neurath presenting the idea that standard living has to be multidimensional, that you can't reduce to a single monetary measure. Everything we've been talking about is there. And on the other hand, you've got this critique of Neurath in the by Horkheimer, right? Yeah, and so what's going on here?
Yeah, what's
right?
happening?
what's yeah. happening? And I think it's part of the development of the Frankfurt School, actually. So you've got this early, quite interdisciplinary and often quite empirical phase of the Frankfurt School, which has got a lot in common with that kind of Neurathian anti-metaphysics. You've then got this shift to the whole problem being about technocratic reason and the domination of nature. And that, and the picture of Neurath as a technocrat really comes through that. And it's important for actually thinking about what's happened with ecological thought and political ecology ever since, because you've actually still got the tension between the two different traditions, right? Yeah. So you've got a tradition which I might call a physicalist tradition, which is basically saying, we talked about before, what are the physical conditions for human and non-human flourishing? And it runs through conservation policy. It's science-based. It's quite anti-metaphysical. You have physical indicators of human well-being, biophysical indicators, and you've got that through. And there's a real influence with Neurath and the Vienna Circle via people like CAP onto development of that one. And then you've got a much more cultural tradition which says, you know, the environment's part of a cultural crisis. It's critical of science. It's critical of instrumental rationality. And that comes through the Frankfurt School. And I think what's happened is we've still maintained that. And it's almost that bifurcation happens round about this time, right, with this debate. And you get this shift then with Horkheimer towards a much more friendly relationship to a German idealism than they had before. And this Adorno and Horkheimer moving into the dialectics of the Enlightenment and the critique of instrumental reason and so forth. Neurath wrote a response to it, right, yeah, which is out in German now. There are English translations of it, but Horkheimer refused to publish. He says the journal wasn't a place for debate of this kind, right, yeah. So he refused to publish it. And it's, I'll come back to that later on. Neurath does there is he says that, you know, the identification of logical empiricism with this belief in just the power of the special sciences is false, but you've got to have a scientific self-reflection on science itself, but it's got to be still empirically informed. So you still have this strong anti-metaphysical dimension that's going on there, right? Yeah. And yeah, so it's a kind of scientific self-reflection on science, and by science he simply means, you know, systematic empirical inquiry of various kinds. So you can have it's another interesting thing about the relationship between logical empiricism and later developments in the philosophy of science. So the kind of Kuhnian response, I mean, which was interesting. I mean, that, you know, the Scientific Revolutions book was actually published within the Unified Science hit series. That's where it came out. But actually, it picks up on themes which are much clearer there in Neurath and Frank. This is not Joseph Frank now, but his brother, right, who was the philosopher of science, which was on sociology of science and seeing science sociologically as well. So you've got that kind of sociological self-reflection, the empirical study of science, reflecting on science, but it's still within this empiricist tradition about how we think about science, looking at science itself now as an empirical phenomena to be studied sociologically. So you get that whole dimension there that's within Neurath. And I won't go through the details of the response, but that's there in the paper, this kind of picture of the scientific self-reflection on science itself. And people have just forgotten that that debate existed. It's one of a series of debates that exists in letters and papers. The other one that I didn't mention earlier on, there was the debate between Hayek and Neurath, which is just in letters. It's not, and Neurath wrote a response to Hayek. But again, because they were going to have a public debate, that's what Neurath wanted, but he died before it could happen. And whether Hayek wanted it is another question. So there's these two really important points, which both, and this is just the reason why I raise it, is both Hayek and the Frankfurt School are responsible for this picture of Neurath and logical empiricism as technocratic. That's both the same claim that they make, right, yeah, and associate it with a certain kind of scientism. And I think for the reasons I've said, what you've then got lost is this really important tradition of understanding of kind of physicalist tradition that Neurath represented. That's there in the thing, but it's the debate between that and the other traditions and the fact that it's not technocratic at all is missed. Where I think it gets interesting, and we've talked about this earlier on, just to bring it back to earlier themes we're talking about in the paper, is that critique of instrumental reason, right? There's a real problem with that in the sense that, as I've always said, it's like instrumental reason isn't all bad, right? Yeah, right, yeah. If you're thinking about, if you're going to the doctor, you want the doctor to use instrumental reason to sort you out. Well, what was the best means we have here to curing you, right? Yeah. There's clearly a place for instrumental reason in life, and to see the problem primarily simply in terms of seeing nature purely instrumentally, I think there's something right about that. But the role that instrumental reason plays, I think, plays an important part. And you get that shift later on with Habermas. So Habermas basically says the problem isn't instrumental reason as such, but it's the colonization of the life world by instrumental reason. And you've got that Kantian idea of the public use of reason as returning. And it's interesting how Kantian the Frankfurt School has become actually in recent times. Right, yeah. Where there's a problem there, and it goes back again to the early debates between Neurath and Hayek, is it tends to leave instrumental reason in the realm of science completely uncriticized. And what is missing there is, and so you've got this notion of we have citizens' juries, public. What they're often concerned about is issues of where science, like climate change and so forth, is coming into policy dimensions, right? Yeah. So we have consensus conference, citizens' panels, public deliberation. And it leaves out the problems about trust in expertise and science untouched. So it's a question about how do we address, and again, this is another problem from the Habermas, the necessary epistemic inequalities that exist, that I don't know the details of climate science, but I need to trust the climate scientist, right? And I've got to address people that just don't seem to trust science at all, right? How do we deal with them? So I think the Habermasian model, which simply sees it as the spread of instrumental reason, right, the colonization of instrumental reason, because it leaves science simply untouched as this box, doesn't actually deal with the central problems. And again, it goes back to the Neurathian problem we talked about earlier on. A central problem in public life is how we're more and more connected with science and scientific expertise. We need it. Right. At the same time, there's a continual struggle between the expert and the common man, as he puts it. So we need democratic deliberative processes about how we deal with that conflict and that tension. Right. And in practice, that Habermasian model of deliberative democracy, oddly enough, that's often where it's put into practice. Right. Yeah. So I think there is a real place for reconciliation between them. And you can see it in that later, the kind of conversations that happen between the Habermasian model and the Neurathian model about how we can think about it, as opposed to the earlier one. And I should just add, I gave a version of this paper at the Frankfurt School, and Rainer Forst was there, right? And we had a really, really good conversation. So whatever hostility existed in the 1930s, I think there's a much more open place for dialogue now. And I think we should actually go back to that missed opportunity that there was for dialogue there.
On that note, I want to bring up one interesting fact, is that Felix Weil, who is the founder of the Institute for Social Research, very interesting man. He wrote a thesis on socialization, and he was very receptive to Neurath's writings in the 1920s,
okay.
So before Horkheimer. And he actually wrote a review of Neurath's economic calculation book from 1925. And he didn't criticize him for being technocratic. It's very interesting. He criticized Neurath. He's like, oh, it's a great book. It's really doing the right thing, but it's a bit too moralistic.
That's really interesting.
He talks too much about, like, you know, all these nice things about how we're going to be good and everything. He's like, he should really get down to the concrete problems of how we're going to plan this economy.
That's a great final note.
Yeah, right. So I just want to say thank you so much, John O'Neill, for being here with me today.
Right. Well, thanks very much for the conversation. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Me too. Ciao.
Critical Theory in Context.